When I asked Matthew Taylor whether one of the legacies of Thatcherism was that politicians now regarded social problems as the result of individual behaviour, he thought it was complex, but overall felt that was the case. There has been a general view, which is, and it is in the move from class to exclusion as conceptions, that exclusion is something which kind of suggests that I'm excluding myself, that there is a process, that my own behaviour is replicated in my social status. Class is something which is given to me. Exclusion is something which happens to me, and which I am somehow an agent. And so I think, yeah, absolutely, there was a sense not that you should blame the poor for being poor, although there was a bit of that as well, but that poverty was a process in which people were active in one way or another, not simply the result of great impersonal social forces. As one of Tony Blair's most senior advisers, and a very perceptive and astute political commentator, Matthew Taylor's honest inside look at some of the philosophies that shape New Labour is revealing. Rather than simply being the result of social forces, your place in society was partly determined by your behaviour. John Cruddas is in no doubt that politicians of all colours have a vested interest in denying the existence of class. It has proved an effective way of avoiding having to address working-class concerns in favour of a small, privileged layer of the middle classes. They devise ever more scientific methods of camping out on a very small slice of the electorate, those who are constituted as marginal voters in marginal seats. Working-class voters were taken for granted as the core vote, who had nowhere else to go, allowing New Labour politicians to tailor their policies to privileged voters. No New Labour politician personified this attitude more than Tony Blair. Matthew Taylor offers an interesting insight into Blair's political approach. I worked for Tony Blair, and the point about Tony is that Tony would always say, when I would say to him, or other people would say to him, what about a bit more kind of leftism in all of this? What about a bit more about poverty and justice and blah, blah, blah? Blair's response was blunt, to say the least. Tony would always say, fine, but I don't need to worry about that, because that's what everybody else in the Labour Party wants, and that's what everybody else in the Cabinet wants, and that's what Gordon Brown wants, and that's kind of fine. And I'll leave them to do that, because I know that's how they'll spend all their time. They don't want to do public service reform. They don't want to do wealth creation. They're not interested in any of that. They'll just kind of hammer away at that agenda. My job is to appeal to the great mass of people on issues that the Labour Party, generally speaking, is just not interested in. The near obsession with ignoring working-class voters meant inflating the importance of a very small tranche of wealthy voters who were misleadingly construed as Middle England. After all, an individual in the very middle of the nation's income scale only earns around £21,000. You're probably right that we did misportray Middle England, admits Matthew Taylor. But that, again, I'm afraid, is not just a Labour characteristic. It's characteristic of the middle classes as a whole. This distortion sometimes reached absurd levels. Stephen Byers is a former New Labour cabinet minister and one of Blair's closest allies. In 2006, he floated the idea of abolishing inheritance tax in order to win back Middle England, despite the fact that only the wealthiest families in Britain were liable to pay it. There's a particular strand of uber-Blairism which basically is kind of just fucking mad, says Matthew Taylor. And I'm afraid Stephen, who I like personally, I haven't seen him for years, he, I'm afraid, was probably more guilty than anybody else of occasionally floating these kind of mad Blairite ideas. New Labour never did adopt Byers's grovellingly pro-wealthy inheritance tax proposal. Nonetheless, his thinking represented a deeply influential strain of Blairism that sidelined working-class people in favour of the concerns of a tiny but gilded section of the population. It is not just the fetishizing of the demands of the wealthy and powerful that has rendered the working class invisible. The promotion of multiculturalism, in an era when the concept of class was being abandoned, meant that inequality became almost exclusively understood through the prism of race and ethnic identity. Dr. Gillian Evans, a leading anthropologist and expert on social class, argues that while the struggle for class equality was said to have been either squashed or won, depending on your perspective, the battle for racial equality continued through multiculturalism. This saw black and Asian people struggling for greater ethnic and cultural respect, and this has been, relatively speaking, a fantastic resistance movement that is to be celebrated. But because multiculturalism became the only recognized platform in the struggle for equality, Dr. Evans argues that on the one hand, we fail to acknowledge the existence of a multiracial working class, and on the other, the white working classes, forced to think of themselves as a new ethnic group with their own distinctive culture. Most dangerously of all, middle-class people have ended up refusing to acknowledge anything about white working class as legitimately cultural, which leads to a composite loss of respect on all fronts, economic, political, and social. We are rightly encouraged to embrace and celebrate ethnic minority identity, not least as a counterweight to continued entrenched racism. But a racialized white working class is not seen as having a place in this classless multiculturalism. There are, after all, no prominent respected champions for the working class in the way that there are for many minority groups. The interests of working class ethnic minority people ended up being ignored too, because the focus is on building up the ethnic minority middle class by ensuring diversity within the leading professions. Yet as New Labour lurched from crisis to crisis under Gordon Brown, it became increasingly difficult simply to pretend the working class did not exist. The racist BNP was growing in working class communities in, for example, East London and North West England. But New Labour politicians took the rising working-class backlash against immigration at face value, instead of examining underlying causes such as lack of affordable housing or secure, well-paid jobs. Rather than focusing on the economic ills shared by the working class of all creeds and colours, New Labour redefined them as cultural problems affecting the white working class. The white working class became one marginalised ethnic minority, among others. For example, back in 2009, New Labour launched a £12 million project specifically designed to help white working class communities. Of course it is true that there are many working class, and yes, largely white, communities that have been neglected or even abandoned by New Labour and are in urgent need of help. But this approach takes us further down the road of linking the problems of working class communities to their ethnic identity, rather than to their class. More dangerously, it encourages the idea that working-class people belonging to different ethnic groups are in competition with each other for attention and resources. The thoughtless comments by New Labour Minister Margaret Hodge in 2007 epitomised this view. Her cack-handed response to the rise of the BNP in her constituency was to complain that migrant families were being given priority for homes over people with a legitimate sense of entitlement. Instead of demanding her government do something about its shoddy record on social housing, she made the interests of white working-class people and of immigrants seem pitted against each other. White working-class people living on estates sometimes just don't feel anyone's listening or speaking up for them, was how Hazel Blears put it in 2009 when she was New Labour's Communities Secretary. Blears was absolutely correct. Millions of white working-class people did feel unrepresented and voiceless. But for Blears, their concerns were almost entirely defined by immigration. Whilst they might not be experiencing the direct impact of migration, their fear of it is acute. Changes in communities can generate unease and uncertainty. Only when the BNP was breathing down its neck did New Labour start talking about the working class again. And even then it was in a racialized form and restricted to the immigration issue. Above all, it was an exception to New Labour's repudiation of working class values and its emphasis on everyone joining the middle class. If you want to explode the myth that class is dead in modern Britain and that anyone can rise to the top through their own efforts, the Palace of Westminster is a good place to start. MPs swan in and out of meetings with lobbyists and constituents, occasionally popping to the chamber to speak or vote when called by the piercing division bell. Overwhelmingly from middle-class professional backgrounds, the combined salary and expenses of the average backbencher comfortably puts them in the top 4% of the population. Scurrying around after them or gossiping over lattes in Portcullis House is an army of fresh-faced, ambitious parliamentary researchers. With unpaid internships, often quite unlike their bosses, without even expenses provided, almost always a prerequisite for making it onto an MP's staff rolls, Parliament is a middle-class closed shop. Only those able to live off the financial generosity of their parents can get their foot in the door. At the service of MPs and hacks alike are the cleaners and catering staff. Many of them trek across London on night buses to arrive in the House at the crack of dawn. Their wages place them easily in the bottom 10% of the population. Until a fight for a living wage was successful in 2006, the cleaners of the mother of all parliaments were subsisting on the minimum wage in one of the most expensive cities on the planet. Watching middle-aged women trundling around trolleys containing the leftovers of roast chicken and chocolate gâteau, you can be forgiven for feeling as though you had walked into a Victorian aristocrat's manor. It would be easy, but lazy, to portray Parliament as a microcosm of the British class system. It isn't, but it certainly showcases the gaping divides of modern society. When I interviewed James Pennell just before the May 2010 election that brought the Tories and their Lib Dem allies to 10 Downing Street, I put to him how unrepresentative Parliament was. Two-thirds of MPs came from a professional background and were four times more likely to have attended a private school than the rest of the population. When I referred to the fact that only 1 in 20 MPs came from a blue-collar background, he was genuinely shocked. 1 in 20? When I asked him if this had made it more difficult for politicians to understand the problems of working-class people, he could hardly disagree. Yes, indeed, I think it's become very much a closed shop. For Pennell, this middle-class power grab was the result of a political system that has become closed to ordinary people. In the build-up to the 2010 general election, a number of excited headlines claimed that trade unions were parachuting candidates into safe seats. "Unions put their candidates in place to push Labour to the left," bellowed the Times. And yet in the end only 3% of new MPs were former trade union officials. There was no similar outrage about the number of prospective candidates with careers in the city, the sector that, after all, was responsible for the biggest economic crisis since the 1930s. 1 in 10 new MPs had a background in financial services, twice as many as in the 1997 landslide that brought Labour to power. Politics has also increasingly been turned into a career rather than a service. A stunning 1 in 5 new MPs already worked in politics before taking the parliamentary oath. When you look back at the 1945 Labour cabinet that constructed the welfare state after the ravages of World War II, the contrast is almost obscene. The giants of Clement Attlee's government were Ernest Bevin, Britain's representative on the global stage, Nye Bevan, the founder of the National Health Service, and Herbert Morrison, Attlee's number two. All were from working-class backgrounds, starting life as a farm boy, miner, and grocer's assistant, respectively. It was the trade unions and local government that had provided them with the ladders to climb, enabling them to end up as towering political figures and respected statesmen. But take a look at today's treatment of John Prescott, one of the few working-class members of New Labour. You don't have to agree with his politics to flinch at the class-based ridicule heaped on him. The son of a railway signalman, Prescott went on to fail his 11-plus, and became a waiter in the Merchant Navy. His impressive rise from such roots to the post of Deputy Prime Minister was rarely applauded, however. Tory MP Nicholas Soames, a grandson of Winston Churchill, used to shout drinks orders at him in the House of Commons whenever he rose to speak. Tory MPs and journalists who have benefited from hugely expensive private educations mocked his occasionally garbled English. When he entered the House of Lords, that retirement home for the ruling elite, the Telegraph's chief leader writer scoffed, "I'm not sure ermine suits John Prescott." The comments left by Telegraph readers on the newspaper's website were a class war free-for-all. One passed on a friend's hilarious description of him as "the builder's bum crack of the Labour Party." barren pie and chips, and Prescott is a fat peasant, were other witticisms, as was, John, here's a little tip, Prescott. Someone has to serve the drinks between debates, guffawed another. Prescott was ridiculed because some felt that by being from lowly working-class stock, he sullied the office of Deputy Prime Minister and then the House of Lords. Working-class people once rose in politics through the mighty institutions of trade unions and local government. But today the trade unions are on their knees, and local government has been stripped of many of its powers. Former London Mayor Ken Livingstone regrets the abolition of the traditional council structure, where working-class people got elected, learned via committees how things are run, and then went to Parliament. That's gone. There's a lot of people that used to be on Lambeth Council or Camden Council who weren't terribly good in terms of literacy and numeracy, but loved representing their area and could work the machine and the council. They didn't have to have bloody A-levels or degrees to do it. In that sense, the barriers against the working class are stronger now, not because an aristocratic elite is keeping them out, but because a sort of middle-class layer has introduced too many qualifications, rules and regulations. You are more likely to make it to Parliament if you're a middle-class, Oxbridge-educated former special advisor these days. When I spoke to Peter, a leisure centre worker in East London, he summed up the scepticism many working-class people feel towards the political establishment. I think they're on a different wavelength. I think most of the politicians are very rich and don't understand the normal problems of people because they come from a different background. And, you know, you see them all on television, most of them are very wealthy, so they wouldn't understand our problems, you know. It was his firm belief that they would never know what normal people go through. This is a fundamental point in understanding politicians' demonisation of working-class communities. It is, of course, largely down to the legacy of Thatcher's assault on working-class Britain and the establishment of the consensus that individual salvation can only be achieved through joining the middle class. But this consensus has established itself so easily in Westminster because our increasingly privileged political elites were, and are, fertile ground for these kinds of ideas. They are largely disconnected from working-class communities and cannot imagine anyone not sharing their middle-class values and aspirations. They find it easy to explain working-class problems as the consequences of personal behaviour, not the social structure of the country. Above all, stereotypes about the working class have found a sympathetic hearing from overwhelmingly middle-class politicians who have rarely mixed with people with less privileged backgrounds. The shadow of Thatcher's class war and the demonising of working-class communities by both the Tories and New Labour have had drastic consequences. Political trends always exert a profound influence on the culture. The repercussions of the attack on working-class values and institutions have fanned out through society. Like Westminster, our media and entertainment are dominated by the most privileged sectors. They have been all too ready to put working-class people down in the crudest possible ways. Chapter 4. A Class in the Stocks. Treorchy in the Rhondda is chav-infested, although here people don't even know what a chav is, the reason being that everyone is a chav. There are no posh folk as the place is working class and unemployment is rife. Chav Town's website. There has never been an age when the working class were properly respected, let alone glorified. From the Victorian era to World War II, working class people were barely mentioned in books. When they appeared at all, they were caricatures. As one expert on Victorian literature put it, even a middle-class supporter of reform like Charles Dickens presented working-class people as having the two-dimensional qualities of cartoon figures. George Orwell observed, "If you look for the working classes in fiction, and especially English fiction, all you find is a hole. The ordinary town proletariat, the people who make the wheels go round, have always been ignored by novelists. When they do find their way between the corners of a book, it is nearly always as objects of pity or as comic relief." And yet things did change after World War II. Labour, the party created by working-class people to represent them in Parliament, had won a landslide victory, and was there to stay as one of the country's two major political forces. Sweeping social reforms were introduced to address working-class concerns. Trade unions enjoyed influence at the highest levels of power. Working-class people could no longer be ignored. "The war changed everything," says Stephen Frears, a film director who often weaves class themes into his work, from early television serialisations of Alan Bennett plays to the 1985 classic My Beautiful Laundrette. "Novels started being about the working classes. Plays started being about the working classes. I found all of that very, very interesting." For someone from a middle-class background like Frears, this was a profoundly liberating experience, what he refers to as his emancipation. There was suddenly a whole group of people who'd never been heard before, really. The focus before had been on such a narrow range of subjects in Britain, which was those who live the life of the upper classes or middle classes, whatever, so suddenly the world became more interesting. Although there had been fleeting TV programmes with working-class main characters before, Coronation Street was the first in which working-class people and their lives were the central focus, and with their lives portrayed in a sympathetic fashion. They included Ina Sharples, a caretaker, and David Barlow, an apprentice engineer. It struck a chord, and within months attracted over 20 million viewers. It rode the wave of so-called Northern Realism, a new genre of film that explored the realities of working-class life. Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, A Taste of Honey, Room at the Top, and Kathy Come Home were classic examples. While working-class people were the stars of favourites such as The Likely Lads, it was middle-class people who could find themselves the butt of jokes in The Good Life and other series. There was even a popular sitcom in the 1970s, The Rag Trade, about female trade unionists who took on their bosses and always won. As late as the 1980s, there were classic TV shows being written around likeable working-class characters, such as Only Fools and Horses and Auf Wiedersehen, Pet. That is not to say that the portrayal of working-class life was always completely realistic. I think there was an awful lot of romanticisation of the working class and their communities, say, 30, 40, 50 years ago, says historian David Kynaston. If you think about the portrayals of the working class in the films of the immediate post-war period, often they show working-class people as sort of buffoons, but not as villains or unpleasant. It was more kind of one-dimensional. They might be uncouth, but nevertheless not bad people. Former Labour leader Neil Kinnock agrees. "For a very, very long time, certainly in much of the 20th century, the working class was idealised by a small number of very influential intellectuals, people in the arts and education, otherwise it was patronised." There was a big leap from being patronised to being despised. The shift would come with the advent of Thatcherism and its assault on what you could call working classness, working-class values, institutions, industries, and communities. The big shift in portrayal is surely, and it's an obvious point, but it's surely a true point, that from about the 80s it became possible in the media to, as it were, disparage the working class in a disrespectful and wholly unkind way, as David Kynaston puts it. Among the earliest examples of these sentiments filtering into popular culture were two characters invented by comedian Harry Enfield, Wayne and Waynetta Slob. First appearing in 1990, they could be regarded as proto-chavs, feckless, foul-mouthed, benefit-dependent, and filthy. When Waynetta, a nightmare prol, as one journalist put it in 1997, becomes pregnant, for example, the couple debate calling their unborn child Ashtray. Even today, the media enthusiastically use Waynetta Slob as a template when attacking groups of working-class people. "Rising toll of Waynettas, with three times as many women as men signing on to sickness benefits under New Labour," screamed one recent Daily Mail headline. Underneath a photo of a greasy-looking Waynetta Slob holding her baby was the thoughtful caption, "The type of people mocked by Harry Enfield's character Waynetta Slob have, sick, increased." But it was the emergence of the chav phenomenon that brought together previously disparate prejudices against working-class people. The website Chav Scum was launched at the end of 2003, with a tagline reading, "Britain's peasant underclass that is taking over our towns and cities." In its current incarnation, Chav Towns, contributors compete over attacking chavs. Entries can be simple, like, "Shitty council scum people, living in shitty council, ex-council housing," for example. Another targets the chavs of the town of Leek, who spend their days on the checkout at Aldi or working in the delightful Kerrygold cheese factory. The most ambition ever seen in the town made the front page of the Leek Post and Times when one 15-year-old mother of 17 made a passing comment about maybe, sick, working on the deli counter at Morrison's one day. Supermarket employees in Winchester don't come off much better. According to one account, even when they're on the checkout, the customer is always invisible as they chat about pregnancies at 14 and how Crystal got drunk on Friday night and went home with Tyrone, the bastard, etc., etc., ad nauseam. There are entire books dedicated to this genre. For a long time, Lee Bock's The Little Book of Chavs was perched on the counters of the now-defunct bookshop chain Borders. Its most recent edition boasted that it had sold over 100,000 copies and had been reprinted 8 times. It even contains a list of chav occupations to aid identification. If you were a female chav or chavette, you would be a trainee hairdresser, a trainee beautician, a cleaner, or a barmaid. Chav men work as cowboy builders, roofers, or plumbers. There may also be market stall traders, mechanics, or security guards. Both sexes could be spotted at a checkout in low-price supermarket chains like Lidl, Netto, or Aldi, or toiling in a fast-food restaurant. The equally poisonous follow-up book, The Chav Guide to Life, revealed that as well as being loud and lower class, most chavs come from not well-off, working-class families on council estates and get their money from the dole. The creators of the Chav Scum website published their own literary contribution to Chav Hate. In Chav, A User's Guide to Britain's New Ruling Class, Mia Wallace and Clint Spanner offer tips for spotting a chav in the wild. Chavs, you see, are like animals. Cutting-edge fake designer fashion, branded sportswear, and accessories to die for, fabulously extravagant 9-carat gold bling, jewellery, it's all here in this fun-for-all-the-family point-scoring game. A chavette was regarded as an infertile freak by her immediate community if she had not had a child before the age of 17. The chav television channel of choice was ITV Chav, where a chav knows they will never get stimulated or challenged or anything. Unless they are watching This Morning, because with its slightly middle-class aspirations, it can be a bit scary. Worst of all, chav kids were in danger of swamping decent children at schools across the country. There used to be a stigma attached to receiving free school meals, and some poorer families would send their kids in with a packed lunch rather than accept such a benefit. However, as the balance has shifted in schools and many of the pupils now come from a chav background, getting the free meal is de rigueur. Non-chav children are now embarrassed to pay for a meal, and may be set about as the posh kid if they do. As chav hate began to emerge as a force in mainstream culture in 2004, it found supporters in the mainstream press. Jemima Lewis, a Telegraph journalist, responded to the Chav Scum website with a column entitled, "In Defense of Snobbery." Both varieties of snobbery, traditional or inverted, have their perils, but on balance I prefer the former, she wrote, without satire. This is partly because I am middle class and would prefer not to be mocked for it, but it is also because traditional snobbery at least aspires towards some worthy goals: education, ambition, courtesy. Hating the lower orders was good for them, was the crux of her argument. It made them aspire to escape their woeful circumstances and get some manners. For those of its readers who were bewildered by the chav phenomenon, the Daily Mail published a handy A to Z of chavs. A was for A-level, something no chav has ever possessed. U was for underage, what every chavette is at the time of her first sexual experience. The sexual promiscuity of chav women, one of the big obsessions of chav haters, is encapsulated in the male's joke offering. What's the difference between a Chavette and the Grand Old Duke of York? The Grand Old Duke of York only had 10,000 men. And of course, chavs were to be taunted for their low-paid jobs. What do you say to a chav when he's at work? Big Mac and fries, please, mate. Another article by the same journalist suggested that Britain was being overrun by chavs. Some people call them scum, sociologists call them the underclass. But call them what you like, they're taking over the country. Those labelled chavs became frequently ridiculed for failing to meet lofty middle-class standards in what they wore or how they ate. Celebrity chef Jamie Oliver was rightly applauded for his crusade to bring healthy food to the British school dinner menu, but it was a campaign marred by tut-tutting at the eating habits of the lower orders. On his Channel 4 programme, Oliver referred to parents who failed to sit around a table for dinner as what we have learned to call white trash. Indeed, his TV series, Jamie Oliver's School Dinners, focused on poor estates where mothers struggled to feed their kids with what little money they had. Jonathan Ross asked him on BBC One, "Well, do you ever think that some people shouldn't be allowed to be parents, like people from council estates?" It was a joke met with cheers. The same goes for alcohol consumption. When the government's chief medical officer, Sir Liam Donaldson, issued guidelines recommending that children under the age of 15 should not drink at all, Daily Telegraph journalist James Dellingpole became hot under the collar. Sir Liam had had the temerity to suggest that offering young kids small amounts of wine was a middle-class obsession, but Dellingpole thought he was aiming at the wrong target. We all know where Britain's most serious child-drinking problems lie, on sink estates and among broken homes, where rudderless urchins are routinely downing alco-pops and cans of super-strong lager before they've reached their teens. The middle classes had been attacked because they were a soft target, while the real culprits had been let off because even if they were capable of reading a newspaper, they wouldn't give a stuff. Never mind that a study by the National Centre for Social Research found that children from affluent backgrounds were the biggest drinkers, and teenagers with unemployed parents were less likely to have even tried alcohol. This seems to indicate that young people of very low social position may be less likely to try alcohol, possibly because it is less likely to be available in the home, said the researchers. But Dellingpole was merely fleshing out the stereotype that while the middle classes consumed alcohol in a respectable, cultured way, the lower orders spent their time rolling around in a drunken stupor. It was their lifestyles that needed regulating, not those of the civilized middle class. Middle-class journalists were also affronted by the bad manners of the chavs, so much so, in fact, that they used their well-paid columns to launch snooty attacks against people who lack a platform to defend themselves. The Daily Telegraph's Janet Daly has a particular distaste for the unwashed masses. She cannot even go to the theatre without a gang of boisterous, inebriated chavs who will disrupt the performance and may threaten you with assault if you upbraid them. Meanwhile, the National Gallery had been overwhelmed by a human barricade of dossers and fun-loving exhibitionists. Of particular concern to Daly were the yobs, who by going on holiday forced her to flee to those parts of abroad which the louts ignore. What perturbed her most was that these people were neither poor nor unemployed. Indeed, most of them had the sorts of jobs that would once have been described as respectable working class. The truth was that rude working-class people were ruining the holidays of sensitive, superior people like herself. Daly wanted the middle classes to civilize the lower orders, but they were prevented from doing so. It is bourgeois guilt that prevents those who would impose standards from acting. The socially privileged simply cower and refuse to intervene, for fear of appearing contemptuous of those less fortunate than themselves. Manners belonged to the middle classes, and it was high time that they sorted out the impertinent chavs. Not that the born and bred middle classes are the only guilty parties. Some who hail from working-class roots and have achieved wealth and success against the odds have told themselves, "If I can make it, then anyone with the talent and determination can too." Take John Bird, the founder of The Big Issue. I'm middle class. I got out of the working class as quickly as I could, he once said. The working class is violent and abusive. They beat their wives, and I hate their culture. John Bird is far from the only example of a wealthy, formerly working-class individual who spits at those they have left behind. You have escaped, purely because of your own exceptional talents and abilities, you can think to yourself, and those who have not got ahead have only themselves to blame. It would be nice to dismiss chaff hate as a fringe psychosis confined to ranting right-wing columnists, but there is a type of chaff hate that has become a liberal bigotry. Liberal bigots justify their prejudice against a group of people on the grounds of their own supposed bigotry. The racialization of working-class people as white has convinced some that they can hate chavs and remain progressive-minded. They justify their hatred of white working-class people by focusing on their supposed racism and failure to assimilate into multicultural society. It's one of the ways people have made their snobbery socially acceptable, says journalist Johan Harry, by acting as though they're defending immigrants from the ignorant white working class. By defining the white working class in terms of ethnicity rather than social class, liberal chaff haters ascribe their problems to cultural rather than economic factors. It is the way they live that is the problem, not the unjust way society is structured. If white working class people are oppressed, it is the result of their own fecklessness. While a liberal chaff-hater will accept that massive discrimination against ethnic minority groups explains issues like unemployment and poverty and even violence, they do not believe that white working-class people have such excuses. The real working class is supposed to be white, badly educated, aspirational for wealth, bigoted, and easily persuaded, says prominent trade union leader Billy Hayes, who was born on a council estate in Liverpool. Many of these caricatures appeared in the BBC's White Season, a supposedly sympathetic series of programmes dedicated to the white working class that aired in 2007. In reality, it simply boosted the image of white working class people as a race-obsessed BNP voting rump. Their problems were not portrayed as economic. Things like housing and jobs that affect working class people of all colours did not get a look in. They were simply portrayed as a minority culture under threat from mass immigration. The White Season examines why some feel increasingly marginalised and explores possible reasons behind the rise in popularity of far-right politics in some sections of this community, the BBC announced. But the trailer for the series said it all. A white man's face being scribbled over by dark-skinned hands with a black marker pen until he disappeared into the background. Accompanying the trailer was the question, is the white working class becoming invisible? Here it was, all their problems being reduced to the issue of race. Among those reportedly angered by this bias was the BBC reporter Sarah Mukherjee, a woman of Asian origin who grew up on a largely white council estate in Essex. The series left a nasty taste in the mouth, she said. Listening to the patronising conversations in some newsrooms, you'd think white working-class Britain is one step away from anarchy, drinking themselves senseless and pausing only to draw benefits and beat up a few Asian and black people. As an example of how chav-bashing can be justified on anti-racist grounds, take a column written by journalist Yasmin Alibi Brown. Tax-paying immigrants, past and present, keep indolent British scroungers on their couches, drinking beer and watching TV, she claimed. We immigrants are despised because we seize opportunities these slobs don't want. In another column entitled, Spare Me the Tears Over the White Working Class, she slams those who resist calling them racist. Working-class white men provoked race riots through the 50s and 60s. They kept darkies out of pubs and clubs and work canteens. Who were the supporters of Oswald Mosley and Enoch Powell? The disempowered have used us to vent their natural-born hatred against the powerful. Alibi Brown regards herself as a writer of the left, and yet she happily uses a perversion of anti-racism to slam white working-class people. This is chav-bashing as liberal bigotry in full swing. A BBC series presented by Evan Davis tapped into similar sentiments. the day the immigrants left, had the worthy aim of proving that immigrant workers were not, in fact, coming over here and taking all our jobs. But after making 11 long-term unemployed people sign up to do jobs, often badly or failing to turn up at all, favoured by immigrant labourers, the programme portrayed this as a case study of how unemployed working-class people in Britain are slovenly and feckless. The hour-long programme, with its selective examples, ultimately seemed to show that, actually, people in Britain did not have jobs because of their own abject laziness. Columnist Janet Daly is among those who have perversely justified chav-bashing as a defence of ethnic minority people. Recounting a run-in with what she described as an English working-class sociopath, their cars clipped each other and he shouted a bit before driving off, she launched into a tirade against working-class violence. British working-class people were, she said, a self-loathing, self-destructive tranche of the population, who lacked civic culture. In contrast, she celebrated the religion, cultural dignity, and a sense of family brought by ethnic minorities. The only thing holding them back, she claimed, was the mindless hatred of the indigenous working classes, who loathed them precisely for their cultural integrity. I fear long after Britain has become a successful multiracial society, it will be plagued by this diminishing but increasingly alienated detritus of the Industrial Revolution. It is certainly a creative way of justifying hatred of working-class people, but then again, Janet Daly is not simply a snob, she is a class warrior. Another myth used to sustain chaff hate is the idea that the old decent working class has died away, leaving a rump with no moral compass. In one Daily Mail column, Amanda Platel, a former speechwriter for the present coalition Foreign Secretary William Hague, blamed the shabby values of this rump for their situation. When it comes to looking for the real cause why so many of the working class do worse at school, earn less, and die younger, the blame must be placed elsewhere, on the countless number of feckless parents. She even called the mothers of working-class children slum mums. As part of her argument that they were personally responsible for their situation, she argued, "The working class of the past had enormous self-respect. Men, however poor, wore suits and ties. Women scrubbed front steps. Mothers wouldn't have been seen dead wearing pyjamas in their own kitchen, let alone in public." As Rachel Johnson, editor of The Lady and sister of Boris Johnson, puts it, "What we're having is a media which is run by the middle classes, for the middle classes, of the middle classes, aren't we?" She is spot on. The journalists who have stirred up chaff hate are from a narrow, privileged background. Even papers with overwhelmingly working-class readerships join in the sport. Kevin Maguire told me of a sun away day in which all the journalists dressed up as chavs. Chuckle at their venomous columns by all means, but be aware that you're revelling in the contempt of the privileged for the less fortunate. In the current climate of chaff hate, the class warriors of Fleet Street can finally get away with it, openly and flagrantly, caricaturing working-class people as stupid, idle, racist, sexually promiscuous, dirty, and fond of vulgar clothes. Nothing of worth is seen to emanate from working-class Britain. This chaff hate has even become a fad among privileged youth. At universities like Oxford, middle-class students hold chav bops, where they dress up as this working-class caricature. Among those mocking the look was Prince William, one of the most privileged young men in the country. At a chav-themed fancy dress party to mark the end of his first term at Sandhurst, he dressed in a loose-fitting top and bling jewellery, along with the must-have angled baseball cap. But when the other cadets demanded he put on a chavvy accent and stop speaking like a royal, he couldn't do it. William's not actually the poshest-sounding cadet, despite his family heritage, but he struggled to pull off a working-class accent, one cadet told the Sun. Welcome to 21st-century Britain, where royals dress up as their working-class subjects for a laugh. To get a more detailed sense of what the chav phenomenon means to young people from privileged backgrounds, I had a chat with Oliver Harvey, an old Etonian and president of the Oxford Conservative Association. In the middle class's attitudes towards what you would have called the working class, so-called chav culture, you've still got to see class as an important part of British life, he says. Chav is a word Harvey often hears banded around beneath the dreaming spires of Oxford. You'd think people would be educated here, but it's still something people find funny. Unlike other students, he dislikes the term because of its class meaning. I think it shows a patronizing attitude and is rather offensive. It's a word used by more fortunate people towards less fortunate people. Unfortunately, it's now a popular term that has been transplanted into people's everyday consciousness. A place like Oxford is fertile ground for chav hate. Nearly half of its students were privately educated, and there are very, very few working-class people attending the university at all. It helps unlock the truth behind the phenomenon. Here are privileged people with little contact with those lower down the scale. It is easy to caricature people you do not understand, and indeed many of these students owe their place at Oxford to the privileged circumstances that bought them a superior education. How comforting to pretend that they landed in Oxford because of their own talents, and that those at the bottom of society are there because they are thick, feckless, or worse. And yet such open mockery is a recent development, not least, because until quite recently many students felt embarrassed about privilege. To be a middle-class student just 20 years ago carried such a social stigma that many graduates in their 40s recall faking a proletarian accent for their entire university education, says Guardian journalist Decca Aitkenhead. Nowadays, however, a popular student party theme is dressing up as chavs, working-class types with a taste for Burberry but not the budget, whose ideas above their station provide material for half the jokes on campus today. Scouring the internet reveals the disturbing levels anti-chav hatred has reached in society at large. A YouTube video with around 500,000 hits proposes sending chavs to the moon. But who'd care anyway if every chav goes to where there's no KFC, no McDonald's, no High Street? The singer croons cheerfully. Before it was finally removed, a Facebook page with nearly 750,000 members was entitled 400 chavs a year die from Tesco cheap booze. Every little helps. Type kill chavs into Google and you get hundreds of thousands of results like 5 ways to kill a chav and the anti-chav, kill chav scum now. There is even a game called Chav Hunter where you can shoot chavs. Chav Hunter is about killing those pikey fucks who dress like 80s rappers in a sniper fashion, aim for the head. It recommends. But the chav phenomenon has sinister implications beyond revealing the growing hatred within the British class system. In early 2009, Ralph Sermon, a teacher from Nottingham, launched into a tirade against what he called a class of uber chavs. They're not doing anything productive and are costing taxpayers a fortune. He knew exactly who to blame. The offspring of the first big generation of single mothers were children in the 1980s. Now they're adults with their own children, and the problems are leading to higher crime rates and low participation in the labour force. This dismissal of large swathes of young people may well have dire results. The birth of chavs, as parodied by comedians such as Catherine Tate, can leave working-class people feeling patronised and laughed at, writes journalist Hannah Frankel in a thoughtful piece on the education system's approach to working-class people. Catherine Tate's comic character, a lazy teenage girl with an attitude problem and an annoying catchphrase, "Am I bothered?" was just one example of how chav bashing has become national entertainment. Reality TV shows, sketch shows, talk shows, even films have emerged dedicated to ridiculing working-class Britain. Chavtainment has reinforced the mainstream view of working-class individuals as bigoted, slothful, aggressive people who cannot look after themselves, let alone their children. On the one hand, they're served up as entertainment, you know, wife swap, whatever, says Labour MP John Cruddas. And simultaneously, there's something to be feared through this notion of a lawless Asbo nation which is at the gate. The bigots of privileged Britain have truly put an entire class in the stocks. The world of reality television must have been a bewildering experience for the late Jade Goody, a 21-year-old dental nurse from Bermondsey. Before she entered the Big Brother house, her life had been one of gut-wrenching hardship. When she was one, her mum threw out her junky father for hiding guns underneath her cot. When she first saw the film Trainspotting at the cinema, she threw up when Ewan McGregor's character injected himself with heroin. "Those faces that he pulls are the same faces I've seen my dad pull, you see," she recalled. She remembered the first time she rolled a joint for her mother, when she was just 4 years old. When her mother was disabled by a motorcycle accident, Jade was forced to look after her. Losing the use of her arm was infuriating for my mum, and as a result, she often beat me. Because she was born to a mixed-race father, which is why I've got such big lips, she suffered racist abuse both at school and in her local community. "My mum got into fights with a lot of women who lived in our block because she thought they were prejudiced," she said, and her mum took her out of school for similar reasons. She worked in various jobs before getting the job as a dental assistant, but with £3,000 of unpaid rent, she faced eviction from her council flat and possible imprisonment for unpaid tax. That was until 2002, when she sent a promotional video of herself to the new Channel 4 reality TV show, Big Brother. There can be few more shameful episodes in the British media's recent history than the hounding of Jade Goody. The youngest contestant, she reacted badly to the claustrophobic pressure of the TV program. She ate and drank to cope with the stress, she fooled around with one of the contestants, and she was bullied into getting naked on national television, which the producers made sure to feature in the edited highlights. The media despised her. Labelled a pig, she was mercilessly ridiculed for not knowing what asparagus was, the horror, and for asking if East Anglia was abroad. "Vote the pig out," demanded the Sun, which also referred to her as an oinker. Others taunted her as a vile fishwife and the elephant woman. As the campaign became a hysterical witch hunt, indeed one of the headlines was "Ditch the Witch," members of the public stood outside the studios with placards reading "Burn the Pig." It is remarkable that anyone could have turned this avalanche of hatred around, but she did. Her disarming, almost boundless honesty, her disregard for the social graces of respectable society, and her tortured background, gradually endeared her to millions. When she returned to the world of reality TV, it was in the celebrity version of Big Brother. Then came the next wave of anti-Jade spite. Appearing alongside Jade Goody was Shilpa Shetty, an Indian Bollywood actress from a wealthy background. Jade took an evident dislike to her, and there was open war between the two. It was a much misunderstood dispute. Shilpa suggested that Jade needed elocution lessons. When Jade infamously told the Indian actress to go back to the slums, a phrase wrongly taken to be racist in intent, she was attacking her for being what Jade described as a posh upper-self princess who should see what real life was like. "Ultimately, we were fighting because we were from different classes," she would later claim. "Who the fuck are you? You aren't some princess in Neverland," she screamed at Shilpa when she tried to flush a cooked chicken down the toilet. Other celebrities on the show, such as model Danielle Lloyd, suffered less media opprobrium despite calling Shetty a dog and telling her to fuck off home. But Goody's undoubtedly stupid and racially tinged references to the actress as Shilpa Poppadom helped unleash a vitriolic media campaign. "Class versus trash," bellowed the Daily Express. The paper slammed the porcine Jade Goody and mourned the fact that Miss Shetty, a huge star in India, has been forced to endure the kind of bullying usually heard around sink estates. "We are being disgraced around the world by the likes of semi-literate Jade and her unpleasant associates." The Express was outraged because it felt that a thick, ugly girl from a poor background was attacking a beautiful rich woman. "Jade and her allies clearly feel threatened by the presence of a woman from a very different strata, sick, of society from their own," it claimed. Simon Heffer assailed Goody for indulging in the only form of bigotry the law now permits to go unpunished, that of hating your social superiors. He questioned why Channel 4 had to use Big Brother to broadcast the repulsive aspects of society, when we can see them so easily for ourselves, if we wish, by wandering onto the nearest council estate for half an hour. Even Stuart Jeffries in The Liberal Guardian could not resist portraying the clash as between ugly, thick white Britain and one imperturbably dignified Indian woman. He even attacked Jade's garbled English, suggesting she use her fortune for remedial education. But then Stuart Jeffries was being educated at Oxford University, while Jade Goody's heroin-addicted father was hiding guns underneath her cot. On the BBC, Andrew Neil suggested she was just one of a bunch of Vicky Pollards and thick bitches cluttering TV screens. Richard Littlejohn described her as the high priestess of the slagocracy, and others offered her as proof of Britain's underclass. In one BBC phone-in, she was described as just another chav, the estates are full of them. The host laughed and suggested hosing them down. Meanwhile, Hamant Verma, the former editor of East and I magazine, attributed the open display of racism to Channel 4's decision to give near-illiterate chavs such as Jade Goody so much airtime. One writer in the Nottingham Evening Post described Shetty's tormentors as resembling nothing more than a pack of slavering chav-estate mongrels spoiling for a scrap. It was not just Jade Goody under attack in these contributions. It was everybody who shared her background. Those at the bottom of the pile in British society were being presented as little more than animals. They smell, they're dirty, was how literary critic John Carey described attitudes towards the poor in interwar Britain. How much have things changed? As the journalist Fiona Sturgis was to later put it, Goody once again found herself vilified by the red tops and held up as a terrible archetype of the white working class. But when Jade Goody was diagnosed with terminal cancer in 2008, there was genuine and widespread sympathy for her. It was as if the media were trying to atone for their guilt. Well, parts of the media, anyway. When she was initially diagnosed, Spectator columnist Rod Liddle penned a column entitled, After Jade's Cancer, What Next? I'm a tumour, get me out of here. Referring to Jade as the coarse, thick Bermondsey chav, he suggested that the cancer had been invented by her publicist, Max Clifford. Or again, it is not inconceivable, I suppose, that written into Goody's contract was a demand that at some point she be seen to be suffering from a potentially fatal illness, given that without one she isn't very interesting anymore. A stroke would have made for more dramatic television, but cancer, you have to say, has a certain cachet. Just days before Jade Goody's death, some journalists continued to take a pop at her as a proxy for those on the bottom rungs of society. A vulgar loudmouth, she initially appeared on the show as a kind of token Hogarthian lowlife, wrote Jan Moyer, a Daily Mail columnist. First we have this godforsaken wedding, then the christening of her children, then an ungainly lickety-split spring to death, and the ultimate chav-state funeral. Moyer was not alone in attacking Jade's decision to allow television cameras to film her last weeks. When a figure such as celebrated journalist John Diamond recorded his own death from cancer through newspaper columns in The Times, he was applauded. But then again, he was a middle-class man writing for a middle-class newspaper. What does the case of Jade Goody show us, other than the capacity of the British media for crassness and cruelty? Above all, it demonstrated that it is possible to say practically anything about people from Jade's background. They are fair game. Big Brother was not the only reality TV show to lift the lid off class hatred. Wife Swap is a long-running Channel 4 program where two wives with different backgrounds swap families for a couple of weeks. As Polly Toynbee has remarked, it should really be called Class Swap. Invariably, one of the parties is portrayed as a dysfunctional working-class family, feckless, unable to look after kids, bigoted, fag-smoking, beer-swilling, and so on. One former fan complained in an internet review that it was guilty of soon deteriorating into fat, uncouth working-class people slagging each other off between cigarettes and swigging canned lager, inviting a more sneering viewer to tune in. The journalist Toby Young felt sorry for Becky Fairhurst, a 29-year-old mother of three whose marriage fell apart following the programme. "She's an uneducated, white, working-class woman, and the programme's makers left no stone unturned in their efforts to depict her as council trash," he wrote. He could not help but conclude that the programme is designed to appeal to the snob in us. Here was a prime example of that urban species known as the chav. The Jeremy Kyle Chat Show has a similar purpose. Week after week, dysfunctional individuals from overwhelmingly working-class backgrounds are served up as daytime entertainment fodder. Vulnerable people with complex personal troubles are thrown in front of baying audiences. A human form of bear-baiting, as one British judge was to describe it. Intensely emotional problems like suspicions of infidelity and who's the real father scenarios are exploited for the viewer's vicarious thrills. Little wonder it was lambasted by the Joseph Rowntree Foundation as a rather brutal form of entertainment that is based on derision of the lower working-class population. By portraying them as undeserving, it undermines support for anti-poverty initiatives, the foundation claimed. And then, of course, there are the comedy chav caricatures. None has caught the popular imagination like Little Britain's Vicky Pollard, created by comedians Matt Lucas and David Walliams.